From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, it was a political earthquake that shattered friendships, neighborly relationships, and even families. Much of the fissures have been around race, given how Trump has based his ideology on white supremacist views. But Trump's election was just the latest battlefront in the war over race and racism in America, a war that has never been properly reconciled. My guest has written a powerful new book about the necessity of such a reconciliation, needing to happen on a daily basis and in all aspects of our lives. Margaret L. Anderson is the Edward F. and Elizabeth Goodman Rosenberg Professor Emerita at the University of Delaware. She's the author of several books, including Race and Society, The Enduring American Dilemma, as well as Thinking About Women. She's co-edited the anthologies Race, Class, and Gender, and Race and Ethnicity in Society, The Changing Landscape. She joins me now to discuss her newest book, Getting Smart About Race, An American Conversation. Welcome to the program, Professor Anderson.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be on your show.
So, as I said, Trump and what he represents is just the latest sort of battlefront in this war that it seems as though from our origin, this country has struggled with. What is so important about having this conversation around race now in today's America?
Well, I think you have framed that question perfectly because people have been somewhat shocked by seeing the overt racism and white supremacist actions that have come to the foreground since Trump's election. But this is not at all the first time this has happened. It's no doubt deeply disturbing. But I wrote my book because I wanted the public to understand more about how racism has structured our society. And in what I mean by getting smart about race is going beyond some of the simplistic understandings of race, and also knowing that though it is horrifying to see this racial antagonism now, this is something that has been endemic in our society. And I think if we come to understand that more, we are much better equipped to know what to do about it.
So a lot of the studies that you see being done by institutions like the Pew Research Center show vastly different views that Americans have about, say, things like policing or systemic discrimination, depending upon your race. So African Americans may think overwhelmingly, you know, have a certain opinion about, say, police versus white Americans who might feel a lot safer around police. Are those all rooted in the fact that we see these issues through completely different lenses because we aren't talking to one another?
Well, I think that's part of it. And I have to say that as a white woman, I have to step outside of the norms a little bit to think about race differently than I might have if I simply took it for granted in our society. But you're right, the Pew Research Center and other places clearly document some of the differences that appear in people's attitudes about various racial issues. But I also have to believe that most people want to be better about this. Maybe not all, and those probably aren't the people who will read my book. But I wrote my book because people kept saying to me, this is such an important topic. You need to do this in a way that goes beyond the classroom where I've been teaching for so many years. And so I've deliberately written a book that I hope will be read by the general public that might educate us a bit more about race and help to cross some of the differences that you've talked about. Because I do think that good-hearted people really want to find common ground here.
Isn't part of the problem the fact that many Americans who do say things that are racist or have views that are racist don't want to admit that about themselves, and that there is this shame associated with it for good reason. But, you know, this idea of whiteness as the default in our society, it seems to me plays a big role in just even preventing people from being able to admit that something they said or did was actually deeply racist and hurtful to a person of color.
Well, I think that it's very hard to get white people to talk about race because nobody wants to be called a racist. At least I don't think anybody does. I hope no one does. But the problem is that by not being willing to have these difficult conversations, silence just leads to greater reproduction of the same racial problems. So I like to think that we can have these conversations. They require a great deal of empathy on the part of white people. They require questioning some of the white privileges that, as white people, we do enjoy. And white people can't just be the experts on race. It's going to take a tremendous amount of listening, educating yourself, whether that's through film, literature, conversation. So there's a lot of risk for white people in talking about race. But I do think that we need to take this project on. And that's why I've written the book.
You tell a story in your book about a friend of yours and a scarf that gets stolen. And it reminded me of a scene that I saw play out recently in my own life. I was at a drugstore and a white woman with something in her hand walked out and all the alarms went off when she passed the sensors. And clearly she had she'd sort of forgotten to pay. And she turned around and she walked back into the store. And all of the store clerks looked up, looked at her, and then just went about and did their work. And it occurred to me right away, I wonder what their reaction would have been if she had been anything other than a white person or a white woman. Tell me about the story of the scarf and why that is a good jumping off point for these conversations.
Well, the scarf is just such an extraordinary story. So for your listeners and viewers, I am a knitter and I had designed and knit a beautiful scarf for my African-American friend. And she was out to dinner one night and had the scarf draped over the back of her chair. And she sort of noticed, I was not present, but she noticed some movement behind her. And in fact, a white woman had picked her scarf up and started walking out the door of the restaurant with it. And my friend turned to her and said, "Excuse me, that is my scarf." Now, normally you would expect someone to say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, it was an accident." But in fact, the white woman continued to say that it was hers. I mean, such an incredible display of white privilege. Now, that's a scenario that could have gone very badly. As it turns out, my friend simply grabbed the scarf and took it back from her. Now, just imagine if any one of those people had been of a different racial ethnic background. If both had been white, maybe someone would have chalked it up to someone just being mentally ill. Had it been a man, black man, who had taken the scarf, it's quite possible the police would have gotten involved. So I use that to open up the second chapter in my book because I think it's so compelling, as is the narrative that you gave, to help people see just the everyday ways that racism intervenes in the lives of people of color. And it's not all the same, but it is present. And I think it's something that white people can more easily overlook.
And part of the problem is that it's often not even visible, right? I don't think anybody else in that store thought about the incident that I described differently. And, maybe another person of color might have thought about it. But unless we're actively thinking about it, it remains invisible, right?
Well, and I think, even for those of us who intend to combat racism, it can take us by surprise at times. And I'll give you another example. I was in my local drugstore the other day, and a probably 30-year-old white woman was in there and talking about the pharmacist and was clearly very frustrated. And she turned and said, this was a customer in the drugstore. And she just said, "Well, everybody else in this town, they're just Jew boy pharmacists." And I was mortified.
Wow.
At the anti-Semitism. Now, this is, I'm someone who's been teaching about race, dealing with students of different backgrounds and attitudes for many years. And I was so taken aback and so wanted to say something or do something. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't. Now, had it been a clerk in the store, I would have gone to the management and said something. But frankly, our racial atmosphere right now is so charged that I had to stop and think for a minute, if I say something to this woman who is a complete stranger to me, what am I gonna get into here? And there's no one here as an authority because the store has no authority over her. But it's just one more illustration that, for people of color is fairly routine in their lives. And I think as white people hear these stories and, you know, have some heart and some sense of morality, that maybe there's some way that we can work to begin overcoming this. So one of the things I've done in my book is to put in the back of it, I think you may have seen this, discussion questions for people who are in workplaces where they want to talk about these issues, or in community organizations or neighborhoods or even family gatherings. Because if we don't start having these difficult conversations, and obviously conversation isn't enough, we need policy change as well, then I feel we're just going to be stuck in this quagmire.
You write in your book, white privilege makes white people seem to be presumed to be deserving, while people of color are seen as taking advantage because of their race. Do you think that talking about white privilege is more palatable to white Americans when the person speaking is white?
It depends on the context, because the reality is white people are not all equally privileged. And if you say to some struggling white person that they have some kind of privilege, at best, they're just going to think that you're insane, or at worst, they're going to shut down and have a hostile response to you. So I think this has to be a very careful conversation, because the fact is, you know, white people do struggle too. And to me, it's about finding commonality. But what white people don't have is they never suffer the indignities of racism, either on a daily basis in the terms of the microaggressions we've been talking about, or in the more systemic ways that result in discrimination, the historic accumulation of wealth, and so forth. So I think we have to be honest that not all white people benefit equally or in the same ways from white privilege.
And of course, people like Trump recognize that really clearly and take advantage of that to scapegoat, so that if they can convince poor whites that the real enemy aren't corporations or wealthy white elites, the real enemy are poor immigrants or people of color who are taking advantage of government largesse, then their job is done.
And that's been a very long-standing trope in our culture. Always blame the newcomer, the person of color, the Chinese immigrant. You know, that stoking that kind of fear has actually been at the heart of some of our most violent encounters in our nation. And I find it terribly disturbing.
And yet it is problematic when people say it's not really about race, it's about class.
Well, correct, because the fact is that race and class in this country are so deeply intertwined with each other that you can't really talk about one without talking about the other. And I think it, when people say, oh, it isn't really about race, it's really just about class, it overlooks so much of the nuance of racism and its connection to class, because class has been formulated in part because of racial inequality.
I want to ask you about looking back on the origins of the country and the fact that there was never reconciliation, say, for slavery. You will hear a lot of white folks today saying, my ancestors may have been responsible for slavery, but it was nothing that I did. Let's move on and get over it. I didn't cause, you know, slavery to happen or support it or perpetuate it. Why should I be held responsible for it? What is the right response to that?
You know, I heard that so much from my students. So what you've just said is very familiar to me. And I used to do an exercise in my class on racial reparations. And I would start out by asking the class, which tended to be predominantly white, but with some representation of people of color. And I would ask them, you know, did they support the concept of racial reparations? And pretty much most did not. And then we went through an exercise where I asked them to role play different presumed groups, like ancestors or descendants of slave owners, or a group of multiracial students in a student organization. And we had a very long debate looking at every side of the racial reparations debate. And in the end, one student started to understand how advantage accumulates because of policies that may predate their particular lives. Once they understood that and understood more about the transmission of property and the transmission of wealth over multiple generations, I would say few of them came to the conclusion that we should make some sort of cash payment to people because of slavery. But they did change their perspective on social policies. And I would resurvey them after the exercise. And almost universally, it moved them toward a stance of saying there needed to be more investment in education, more investment in community development, and other social projects and social policies that would benefit people of color in particular.
What you just said is the perfect segue for my question around tackling the issue of race on an individual personal level versus on a systemic level. And often when we talk about race and racism, the systemic issues get ignored. But if we don't talk to one another about race and don't change our minds, each other's minds about tackling race, then there isn't the cultural shift that needs to happen to support ending systemic racism, right?
That's true. I mean, what I would say is it's a both and response to your question, that we need change both at the individual level and at the institutional and policy level. They go hand in hand. But yet I know the frustration of people who say, we've been talking about this for a very long time. I mean, really a long time. And talk doesn't in itself get to the heart of the problem. So though I have subtitled my book, An American Conversation, and I would like to see a lot of strong dialogue about this, I'm very well aware of the fact that we've been talking for a long time, and what we need is some actual change and investment in things that will actually start to alter what we see as systemic racism.
Now, a lot of work that has been done among sort of progressive activist groups around race and racism discuss these issues in terms of being good allies. If you're not Black or if you're in a community that's not directly impacted by how the world sees your race, the least you can do is be a good ally. Is that something that can be expanded to the population at large?
Well, this is where I think education is critical. I mean, I am at heart an educator. It has been education in my own life that has changed me from probably having very racist attitudes as a younger person. But my experience in learning more, in committing myself to learning more, to teaching about this, I think has transformed me. And so I'm a case in point. I'm a white middle-class person who grew up with some racial privileges in very different racial environments. But education made a really big difference. And I've really dedicated my own career to trying to integrate more understanding of race, and I'll just throw in here as an aside also gender, to the curriculum at the college level, because I've seen it make a difference in what people think about and what they then commit themselves to doing. And not everybody is going to make the same commitment.
And what's really sad is you have a conservative movement in this country today that needs a population that is filled with resentment to vote for them. And so they have fed this idea about liberal elites in ivory towers, force feeding white kids about white privilege, and who are really anti-education.
Yeah, well, what can I say about that? I grew up in a curriculum that was overwhelmingly white, European. Mm-hmm. I didn't even learn any Asian history in various history courses that I took as an undergraduate. So yes, it's really a problem because there is an attack on people like me. I'll be honest about it. It was early on called tenured radicals. But if we don't take a more critical perspective, we're going to be living, I fear, with even greater racial conflict than we see now. I mean, this is a tinderbox, and Trump, along with others, are, either intentionally or unintentionally, really igniting it.
So finally, I want to pick up on this conversations that we had around, seeing incidents before us. On the one hand, there are incidents that take place where we notice white privilege. On the other hand, there are overtly racist attacks that people suffer, and the silence of others around them is sometimes even more upsetting. I can personally say that that's happened to me, and probably every person of color has been in a situation where they've, you know, suffered a racist attack and wondered why nobody came to their defense. And I'm wondering how important that aspect of these conversations around race is. We can sometimes, you know, feel like deer caught in headlights, wished we could have and should have said something. How can one speak up about racism in a country where speaking up about race and racism is still considered so difficult to do?
Well, I'm going to be more optimistic than sociologists typically are here, because I do see signs of hope here. And if I didn't see any signs of hope, I would just shut the door and go about my business. For one thing, even though these recent acts of racial hatred we've seen are deeply disturbing, it is waking people up. You see younger people getting involved in various organizations for racial justice. You see it in things like the Women's March and some of the protests that are taking place. You see it when you see multiracial, multi-ethnic people supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, so I do think, as bad as the racism in our culture is right now, it is making people look more carefully at race. And I really hope my book, Getting Smart About Race, can add to that movement. That's my hope.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you invited me. It's very nice to meet you, Sonali.
Thank you. Nice to meet you too. Margaret L. Anderson is my guest. She's the Edward F. and Elizabeth Goodman Rosenberg Professor Emerita at the University of Delaware. And she's written numerous books and co-edited anthologies around race and gender and class. She's been talking to me about her latest book, Getting Smart About Race and American Conversation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.